This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Author David Schickler wanted to be a priest as a young man, but he struggled between his desire to serve God and to be with women. He said, "For me to have become celibate for life would have been to become half-human." The idea of a church led by men that only accepts celibate men into leadership roles is, well, it's a question that continues to trouble many Catholics, has led many people like Schickler to choose another path in life. His book called The Dark Path is our jumping-off point for a conversation that pulls together many threads we've been discussing on our show recently. We recently talked to sex advice columnist Dan Savage about America's difficulty in talking about and teaching about sex, and we've been considering the impact of Pope Francis's recent comments about a change in the focus of the Catholic Church, also looking at the role of women in religious life. So today, Where We Live, a conversation about celibacy and about religion with a panel of spiritual thinkers and with you. Join our conversation. Have you considered the religious life? Have you taken a vow of celibacy? Is there something about celibacy that we can learn from? 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WNPR.org, or you can tweet us at Where We Live. Joining us in studio today is our friend Reverend Daniel Tomenio, who has been with us in the past to help us through religious conversations. And we're pleased to have you back, Daniel. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here.
I also want to welcome in Mark LaValle, who's Assistant Professor of Practical Theology at Barry University. He joins us by phone. Mark, thank you for being here as well.
Happy to be here.
And David Schickler is a screenwriter and a novelist, and he's the author of the new book, The Dark Path. David joins us by phone today. Welcome, David. Thanks for being here on Where We Live.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So we're going to start with you, David, and take us through your story. Tell us when you felt you wanted to be a priest.
Oh, I felt it very young. I was raised Catholic, and my family was quite devout. We went to church, you know, every Sunday, but my parents talked about Jesus sort of like he was in the room with us, you know, wherever we were, not in a treacly way, just in a sort of matter-of-fact way. You know, you mentioned that Mark's a professor of practical theology or a doctor of practical theology, and it all felt very practical to me. God was just always there. So I felt very much when I was young, you know, a call to want to continue that conversation and to do that. But my new book, The Dark Path, which just came out, you know, one of the reasons it's titled The Dark Path is because I did feel that there was a sort of almost sentimental presentation of God sometimes on Sundays in church, a super shiny God that I couldn't quite get on board with. The God I was attracted to was a much darker, more mystical God that I sometimes felt in church and often felt on this literal path in the woods behind my parents' house. And that was the, you know, it wasn't that I was just communing with nature. It was still God that I was talking to. You know, I didn't believe that I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a pantheist. I was still a monotheist. But I very much felt, you know, I felt called to be with this darker God, this more mystical God. And so then when I was in high school and in college, I went to Jesuit school, then I went to a Jesuit high school, and then I went to Georgetown University. And I very seriously, you know, looked hard at that road of becoming a Jesuit priest. I knew many Jesuit priests who were friends of mine or even colleagues of mine and, you know, guides in my prayer. And I really felt that that was, you know, was going to happen for me. And then I discovered women.
And maybe we'll get to that in just one moment. I want to get back to something you just said, though. Talk about what you perceived as a sentimental presentation of God in the church. I love this idea, and I think I know what you're talking about, but expand on that for us.
Well, I used to teach high school English and direct high school and drama. And I used to spend a lot of time around young people. And, of course, I myself was, we were all young at one point. But, you know, just this idea of this sort of white glove a presentation of God, the idea that, you know, whoever was in the pulpit would sometimes say, and now we're going to talk to our young people in a sort of higher, safer register of voice, as if we were talking about, you know, Santa Claus and Care Bears as, you know, as the person was talking about God. And that just never tracked for me. Even when I was a child, you know, my understanding was God was a very, you know, not humorless, but very serious, a very, very serious thing to be discussing, the most serious thing. you could discuss. And so the idea that it was all sort of super bubbly and rah-rah and up with people didn't quite work for me or didn't quite track for me. You know, I would, you know, my thoughts would run to, well, what about my grandfather who has cancer? Or what about that really, really poor person there? They, you know, they don't need some cheerleader with, you know, God-colored pom-poms, you know, dancing through their life. You know, they might need uplift, but, you know, my feeling about that was uplift doesn't always come through treacly, uber-shiny language. It comes from the truth. And the Christ that I met in the Gospels, you know, spoke the truth and hung out with, as they say in the Gospel or in the church, you know, tax collectors and sinners and prostitutes. And I think those kinds of people, if they had heard sort of rah-rah boosterism from Jesus Christ, would have laughed him out of the room or kicked him out of the room. And so none of that tracked for me, and I found much more excitement in a darker, more mystical, and more serious God.
Now, Daniel, you come from a different tradition, but I'm wondering if anything about the darker, more mystical God that David's speaking of, it makes sense to you, if that's something you understand.
It does make sense to me, and I think that darker, more mystical God is something that draws a lot of people to faith, because it's a very rich understanding of who God is, and a God with multiple abilities to empathize, that it's a God that can speak into the darker places that we all experience. And for many people, those dark places become a gateway to faith and a gateway to questions about what it means to be a person of faith. And there's a long tradition that Mark can speak to also in Christian thought of thinkers who think very deeply, not just about evil, but about the mystical God and the God that's kind of beyond our ability to put in a box and to comprehend. So the problem with that God is, because it's mystical and hard to comprehend, it's also hard to explain to another person. But I think that not trying to codify or put God in a box can oftentimes be a way to discover more about faith than what people may have assumed before.
Mark LaValle, you want to pick up on that?
Yeah, a couple things there. What Danielle was saying is spot on. There is a rich tradition of God is darkness, God is unknown. You have the Cloud of Unknowing, which is a medieval mystical text. You have St. John of the Cross's basic depiction of God as nada, as nothing, or as darkness. But one of the things to keep in mind is that these mystical traditions have always been on the outskirts, especially of the institutional church. They've always been looked at with glances cast aside. So it's common that still to this day, that is not going to be what you always see presented in Christian communities. You might see more of the white glove boosterism, which, particularly for Gen X Christians, is not going to match with their experience of the world.
I'm Gen X. What makes us different here, Mark, in your mind?
I mean, there's a few things. The theologian Tom Bowdoin wrote maybe a little more than 10 years ago, a great book on Gen X spirituality. And one of the marks is a distrust of institutions, a notion that faith is found in ambiguity. I saw it really shot all throughout David's book, which I thought was excellent. His notion of at times calling God not there, or God may be there. Faith is found in some ways necessarily through ambiguity. And there's also a certain irreverence as well. The relationship between one's spirituality and pop culture. Many Gen Xers are formed within the culture of the later 60s through the late 70s. And that's just suffuses the spirituality of this generation, finding the religious dimension in key experiences of suffering, like in the world, the Iranian hostage crisis, the Challenger explosion, and just personal experiences, didn't really match up with the faith presentation that our parents had presented to us.
I'm wondering, David, if you might pick up on that. I mean, do you think there's something to this, that your experience going through your childhood and your decision whether or not to enter a spiritual life had something to do with when you grew up, the fact that you are indeed a Gen Xer and we have some certain things that we're carrying around with us?
Well, I think all of that is very interesting. I do think that the late 60s through the late 70s, I can speak to mostly to the Catholic tradition of what was going on then, because that was, you know, post Vatican II, or really the vanguard of what Vatican II was as it moved out into the culture, in America, and what that brought with it was, well, a lot of really bad acoustic guitar music, because there were a lot of excited, Catholic almost hippies or something that wanted to bring a certain new kind of excitement or familiarity with God into services. And I respected that to the nth degree, And so at a baseline, I mean, I sort of plug my ears sometimes because Catholics can't sing. I'm not trying to make, too much of a blanket cultural statement, but most Protestants, my wife included, do sort of, sometimes when they're at Catholic services, they're like, well, you guys really care about a lot of this stuff, but a lot of you needed to go to choir practice. but I will. I don't mean to digress. What I really feel like, and I appreciate what Mark was saying about popular culture and what it means for somebody from Gen X, from Generation X. For me, and this, I can't say what it would have been like for me in any other generation. But a search for excitement is something that I definitely have. I'm a screenwriter and I'm a novelist. A search for excitement and trying to be a bringer of excitement is important to me. I want to be excited when I'm looking at story, and when I'm, I want to be captivated. I want there to be adventure, sex, violence to a certain extent, meaning, some sort of exciting disruption of the norm. When I look at story, well, I want all those things, and I think people my age also want those things out of God and out of their belief system. And if they feel that it's not there, and this is what I mean by the white glove stuff, they're going to turn away. And that is why, for me, I needed God to be exciting. And the Christ that I met in the Gospels was exciting. And the best priests that I listened to, some of whom were missionaries, some of whom just lived in the same, traveled in the same social circles or world that I lived in, but they were exciting people, and they talked about God in an exciting way, in a cutting-edge way, and it seemed for them, yes, true, faith brought comfort, but it also brought an edgy danger to their lives, that this was a dangerous thing to think, that this was a dangerous guy to follow.
What I want to do is just break in quickly, just because I want to let our listeners know that we're talking with a panel of deep religious thinkers here, and keying our conversation off of the new book by David Schickler, The Dark Path. It's a memoir of his. Mark LaValle also joins us. He's from Barry University. Danielle Tomenio is with us in studio, and we're taking your calls at 860-275-7266. Stephen is calling from West Hartford. Hello, Stephen. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Thanks very much. This is an exhilarating conversation for me. I grew up in an Irish Catholic family, and as an undergraduate, studied religion. I spent a year preparing to begin with the Jesuits. Ended up not going in the direction of priesthood, of ordained priesthood per se, but did finish a degree at Divinity School and taught religion and taught theology for a while. My career then went off in a different direction, in terms of creativity, the same as the screenwriter. I'm in the art business. And, you know, my faith and my spirituality is still part of who I am. And I continue to kind of live my life and move on, but sometimes regretting in certain instances that the priesthood was not something that worked out for me. Until my daughter became very seriously ill when we were on vacation in Florida. She had been stung multiple times by a jellyfish and had trouble breathing. And we ended up having to rush her into the hospital in an ambulance and spent an agonizing period of time waiting for her to recover, for her breathing to return, for her levels to return to normal. And I remember driving, this is my point, I remember driving home at 3 in the morning back to the hotel and realizing for the first time what all of that theological language of God the Father and that paternal love, or that parental love, let's make it gender neutral, that God as being the source of such deep parental love, in the pain and anguish that comes from seeing a child suffer, if that is the core of what Christ is and the Son of God is in Catholic theology, I never would have understood that had I not chosen to go from the priesthood and instead have a family. My priesthood was ultimately discovered on Route 1 in Florida at 3 o'clock in the morning in a rented car.
My goodness. Stephen, that's a wonderful story, and I truly appreciate you sharing it with us today because it's pertinent to so much that we're talking about. Thank you again.
No problem.
What we're going to do is break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how a few of our guests made the same choice that Stephen did and how their lives turned out. We want to hear more from you as well at 860-275-7266 as you consider issues like celibacy and the church. We're also talking with Reverend Danielle Tomenio, talk about the role of women in religious life today. You can join us, 860-275-7266. And this is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Author David Schickler wanted to be a priest as a young man, but struggled between his desire to serve God and to be with women. It's one of the themes that we're tackling as we jump off in a religious conversation on his book, The Dark Path. It's a new memoir by David Schickler, who's also a screenwriter. He joins us by phone today. Mark LaValle is an assistant professor of practical theology at Barry University. He joins us on the phone. And Reverend Danielle Tomenio, who's led us in religious conversations in the past, joins us in studio today. And we want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. If you considered the religious life yourself, 860-275-7266. We want to get back to your decision, David, in just a moment. But Mark LaValle, tell us your story about almost becoming a priest.
Yeah, I grew up Catholic. I still am Roman Catholic. It was interesting reading David's memoir because there was so much in it, his early formation, his early, you know, romantic longings for his childhood wives, that I found to be so much like my own experience. I went to a Catholic college that was run by a Roman Catholic monastic community. And after graduating and going to grad school and doing some other things, I started to feel like that was the kind of life that had always been welling up within me that I never had really tried out, so to speak. And so I decided to enter, and the way that, and it's similar for the Jesuits as well. There's a process to entering. You don't just become ordained a priest, you know, right away. Since mine was a monastic community, I wasn't necessarily on track to become a priest, but I entered and did a 1 year what's called a novitiate. When you're basically by yourself most of the time, and you learn kind of the monastic way of life, prayer throughout the day, manual labor, meals together, reading, prayer, chanting. And then after my novitiate, which was quite the struggle, I was unable to see my family, things like that. I could see them like once a year. They could come and visit me, but I was not able allowed to leave the monastery. But after that year, I decided myself that I still had more that I wanted to discover about the life, and that's when you make what are called simple profession or simple vows, and those are that's a 1 to 3 year kind of period when you have a little bit more, I guess, freedom to do things. I taught at a college, and but during those times, I just still struggled with it. For me, it was hard. The same kind of thing with David. It was hard not to be with someone, a particular person, in an intimate way, and the life itself felt too institutionalized. It wasn't like I was just living in a house with a couple other dudes, like being in a fraternity or something like that. And it was just I just decided that it wasn't quite the way that I wanted to live the rest of my life.
Well, I'm wondering if you, I didn't get your reaction to something David said earlier. He was almost talking in his mind. This is the notes I wrote down, and I may be putting words in your mouth here, David, but it sounds to me as though David was wanting a sexier, more exciting God, something that was a little bit different than what the priesthood or the monastic life might offer one. Mark, did you feel that in a certain way yourself?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, the reality is always different than your expectations. I credit, actually, Henry David Thoreau with my desire to enter the monastery for the most part, because I wanted, as Thoreau said, to live life at the core, to suck the marrow of life, and it was that kind of dangerous compulsion. I mean, monastic life is as contemplative as you possossibly can get in Roman Catholicism. And for me, that spoke of kind of the dangerous God, but in a way, it just didn't exactly turn out to be where I'd be able to find that. You have to be able to make it your own, I guess. And if you can't do that, then, you know, it's not probably, you know, what your vocation is, I would say.
Now, David, one of the things that's at the core of your book, of course, is the idea of celibacy being a key component of the priesthood. You mentioned earlier that there are many things that you were going through, struggles in your life, thoughts that you had about God, and then, of course, you met women. Talk about that piece of this, about the role of celibacy and how that maybe changed or shaped your thinking.
Oh, do I get to talk about women now? Well,
we made you wait for a while, but now please do.
No, I mean, I feel this very strongly. You know, the issue of celibacy in the Catholic, you know, in the Catholic Church, I mean, we can talk about it from a social perspective, a theological perspective, everything that the new Pope is saying, et cetera, but for me, it ripped me apart, the idea that, I mean, I wanted to be a priest, and the idea that, but I also grew up in a household with three sisters and no brothers, and my sisters had a lot of really good-looking friends who were over all the time, and I came to love girls and women very early in life, and there was a certain, you know, social, yeah, of course I was sexually attracted to them, of course, but you know, a certain sort of sociability, a totally different kind of way of laughing and dancing and moving through the world. And the idea that I was going to have to excise that from my life, I respect very, very much, you know, priests, Roman Catholic priests who have a true call to celibacy, and I think there are some that do. And I think that celibacy can be a great thing. It can free priests and preachers up for an extra kind of way of devoting themselves to other people and to other people's grief and bereavement and to really being there for other people in a special way. I saw priests for whom that was a great thing. I also saw priests for whom celibacy ripped them apart, in the sense that it made some bad stuff come to the surface. And for me, it would have been a nightmare. It really would have been, because even when I was at Georgetown, when I was at a Jesuit university, and sort of would hang out with certain priests, and there were a lot of other guys hanging out with them, and I don't know if I should have just looked at a camera of us in that room and said, "What's missing here?" But it was usually women, and not to put too fine a point on it, but I had a desperately powerful love affair with a young woman when I was in college who I thought I was going to marry. In my new book, The Dark Path, is to a certain extent a love triangle between myself and God and this young woman who, I really thought I had to choose between a life with one and a life with the other. And I do think that, in the book I end up having something of a nervous breakdown because of it. And I wouldn't say that that's everybody's experience in the Catholic Church who's thinking about going into the priesthood, but it was certainly mine, and it was a painful one, and women and my wanting to be with them won, and I, not to the exclusion of God. I'm still a practicing Catholic, and my faith is ultimately important to me, and I'm married and have two children, and my wife is the best thing in my life. But it almost broke me to realize that, because I thought that what St. Paul was saying in the Gospels, and I still to a certain extent think this, is that the celibate way, the solitary way, is the better way or the higher way.
Mm.
St. Paul said, "I wish that you could all be like me, unencumbered for the work of the Spirit." Well, I thought that's what God was asking of me, and it was a painful process to realize it wasn't going to be that way. But in the end, a joyful process.
Well, I want to get to some phone calls, too, because some people want to ask some questions and have some thoughts about this very topic. 860-275-7266. Derek is calling from Windsor. Hello, Derek. You're on Where We Live.
Yeah, John. Great show. Two questions. And I grew up a Christian, and I never can understand. I want to ask you guys if there is two gods. Because in the Christian community, marriage is what we embrace. And as a minister, oftentimes they would preach, it's better to get married than to, remain single. And why is it so different in the Catholic? Why is the Catholic have to remain celibacy and to become a priest? And could this lead to some of the abuse that we've been seeing? Because humans are sexual creatures. And if you just stay without marriage, at some point you're going to feel led, to walk out the line, step out the line, if you will. And I'm asking the priest, could this lead to some of the sexual abuse that's been here in the sexual scandal? Because it's hard to live without a woman, I can tell you that.
Derek, I thank you very much. It's a great question. I'll put to Dr. Mark LaValle. I think Derek asks a key question that an awful lot of people ask. Why exactly is it that Catholic priests can't be married in a church in a Christian community where marriage is otherwise held as very sacred and very important?
Right. It's always a perennial question, and a good question at that. There's a long, long history of celibacy in Christianity, especially from beginning with St. Paul in many ways, as David pointed out. The Christianity has always, from the beginning of its history, felt that celibacy was a good practice. From St. Paul onto the desert monastics, the early Christians, there's various ways that theologians explain it. For St. Paul and the earliest disciples' viewpoint, some theologians will argue that it's because one of the reasons why they favored celibacy was because they thought that the coming of the return of Christ was imminent. So, marriage might just be something that might distract your mind from what is an imminent return of Christ. But of course, all the apostles themselves were married and as Paul said, you know, better to be married than to, you know, than to burn with lust for women and not be married. It doesn't become officially mandated for priests really until the 12th century, when you have I believe the Lateran Council, that the Fourth Lateran Council, that would mandate celibacy. And some people point in the Middle Ages that you'd have trouble with priests' heirs or children wanting to inherit properties that really the priest belongs to the church and not to the individual priest. But celibacy was always favored, and probably to this day, still in many traditions within or many spheres of Catholicism, would still be considered a higher calling than married life. Although in the past 20 or 30 years or so, that's kind of been rethought that marriage is an equally holy calling. The Second Vatican Council talks about the call to holiness of all people and different ways of living that, whether married or single and celibate or priestly or vowed religious, like a nun or a nun or sister or a monk.
Mm. Well, I'd love to actually get Reverend Tomenio's thoughts on this. Daniel, what do you think?
Well, so I think Mark's right. There's a very long Christian tradition of affirming celibacy. And another part of that is that all Christians take a vow to try to live like Jesus. And there's a long history, whether it's true or not, I will leave to biblical scholars, but a long history of believing that Jesus wasn't married and that Jesus was celibate. So priests in all traditions take that vow in a very particular kind of way to live out their lives the way Jesus did. And so for Catholics, in order to live like Jesus, you have to be like Jesus in a certain subset of ways. So you need to be celibate because that's the tradition that that the Catholic Church commits itself to. And you need to be a man. So you need to share a similar body to the body Jesus had. In the tradition that I come to, from, the Episcopal Church, priests take a vow to live like Jesus with a somewhat different understanding of what that means. So for us, the historical particularities of Jesus's body being a male's body doesn't prevent a woman like me from being able to commit herself to living out certain aspects of Christ's vocation, teaching the sacraments, preaching, because we're called to that subset of activities, not to sharing a certain body. Likewise, my tradition doesn't promote celibacy in the priesthood, though it's certainly a very beloved tradition and affirmed tradition, in part because of what Mark said, that there are historical examples of priests who were not celibate in the early church, and also because we are all called to be who God intends us to be, and so for some of us, marriage is part of that calling. For some of us, celibacy is part of that calling. But I think for any Christian, there's a sense that the point of being celibate or of being married is I think there's a false dichotomy of saying if you're married, you're committing yourself to one person. At least in my tradition, I would say in probably the Catholic tradition too, the idea is that you get married to practice loving one person so that you can extend love to other people. It's sort of your marriage is a practice forum for understanding what it means to love well. For the celibate person, the idea is you don't have that practice arena. You're supposed to be open to loving everybody well. So both marriage and celibacy can serve that ability to love your community the way Jesus calls all Christians to love people.
From a very practical application, though, Danielle, I think it might then be limiting for those who are, say, entering marriage through the Catholic Church to be advised by someone who's taken this vow of celibacy and who, unlike yourself, can't firsthand understand some of the very things that he, and it's always a he, that he would be opining on, that he would be giving you counsel on. Do you see that in some ways, without passing any judgment here, see that as a limitation in the church in the way it's constructed, Danielle?
Excuse me, in the Catholic Church? No, I don't. You know, to play devil's advocate, I don't. And the reason I say that is because whatever walk of life you come from as a priest, you're going to have to interact with people who come from a different background. And so, you know, I've done baptismal counseling for families who have babies. I don't have a baby. Does that mean I'm not qualified to do it? I've, you know, interacted with people of different racial backgrounds who have different cultural traditions of their churches. Am I not qualified to be their priest? So I think a good priest, what makes a great priest, is the ability to empathize with people regardless of their difference from you. So a great Catholic priest can do that and can be a great marriage counselor because they've loved people too, maybe not in a sexual way, but they understand what love and commitment means. By the same proxy, a bad Catholic priest won't do it well, just the same way with a Protestant priest that you know, they're only as good as their ability to empathize, I think. And so it doesn't necessarily matter whether you're celibate if you can give good marriage counseling.
I ask this, of course, as a talk show host who has to lead a conversation about something I have almost no idea about almost every single day of the week. It is interesting. It's an interesting question. Let's go to Jack in Montauk quickly, who has a thought. Jack, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, good morning, guys. How are you today?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, as a roaming Catholic that grew up in Jesuit schools, I think that really what we're seeing is undoubtedly that the Catholic Church is becoming a little more aware of its existence in today's world. I think undoubtedly the rule of celibacy comes from the fact that the Church was starting to get concerned that all this land could be somehow taken away by heirs. And I really think that that is what we all need to kind of buckle up for with a new Jesuit pope, is that things are going to change. And like in science, that basically advances one funeral at a time, I think that's what we're seeing now with the Catholic Church. And that's my comment.
Well, Jack, thank you very much for that. And what we'll do is we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll consider a bit more about what the new Jesuit pope might mean for some of this conversation. We're also going to take more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Reverend Danielle Tomenio joins us in studio today. Dr. Mark LaValle joins us from Barry University in Florida. And David Schickler, he's a screenwriter and a novelist and the author of a new memoir called The Dark Path. It's been our jumping off point for today's conversation about religion and spirituality here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, will the federal government still be shut down when the wheelhouse comes back? Let me take a look at the Magic 8 Ball. Yes, all signs point to yes. We will consider the conversation about the government shutdown, what it means for you. Of course, there's no shutting down. Our all-star panelists, which include, as always, Colin McEnroe and Bill Curry, will be coming back to join us. So we'll consider all the week's news coming up tomorrow on The Wheelhouse. Today, we're considering religion, spirituality, celibacy, the new pope, with David Schickler, who's author of The Dark Path. It's a new memoir. He's a screenwriter and novelist who's written about his own path through his religious faith. Also, Mark LaValle is here from Barry University. He's an assistant professor of practical theology. And Danielle Tomenio is an Episcopal reverend, and she joins us in studio. She's helped us to lead some of these spiritual conversations in the past. A lot of people want to join our conversation, so let's go to David in Norfolk. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live. David, hi. You're on the air. I'm going to put David on hold and go to Valentina, who is calling from Hartford. Hello, Valentina. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I can't remember what your name is.
It's John. It's good to speak with
John,
you, Valentina.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
That's
early.
Okay.
I haven't had my coffee. I'm calling to comment on something that the guest actually just brought up as far as, you know, just because she hasn't had a baby, does that mean she can't advise or counsel someone as a, I guess, a member of her congregation on that subject? And I think it's really important to understand that whether it's talking about being a parent or being a spouse or being homeless, or being a victim of whatever, that unless you have experienced that, you honestly, you can't speak to it. You can speak about what you've read and what you've heard from other people, but you've not had the experience yourself. And that doesn't mean that what you have to say is not of value, but it certainly does mean that you absolutely lose a little bit of, I don't know if weight is the word, or pull, or yeah, well, I guess what you say has a little bit less gravity because you haven't experienced it yourself. And just to sort of make that analogy, I am a mother. I've had 4 children. I'm married. There's so much that I've learned in the course of being married, having children, that I would not have had I not been married and had children, had I been celibate. there's so much I've learned as a woman that I likely could not have experienced as a man, if only because men don't have the same body parts. I assisted in the delivering of a baby once at a hospital. This was my first time sort of being at a hospital helping someone to have a baby as opposed to having one myself. And it was so obvious to me that the other people in the room, the medical professionals, you know, they didn't get to where they are in their career by having 4 kids and being a stay-at-home mom. And so in terms of them speaking to the person that I was assisting, it was so clear to me that, you know what, they've never been in this place. They don't know what it's like to be lying on the table. And you're naked. And something's happening to your body that's never happened before. And something's about to pop out of your body. And they seem to really lack an understanding of what that feels like and what that experience is like. And that affects how they communicate with people as a professional. I provide that just as an analogy to the fact that you can't. I said a lot about being married before I got married. I said a lot about having kids before I had kids. Not all of it was wrong.
And Valentina, what I'm going to do is, and thank you very much. First of all, it's another great story, and I just want to go quickly back to David Schickler because we're running a little low on time, and I wanted to have him comment on that. David, that's the second caller we've had who has essentially said something like, if I hadn't have had kids, if I hadn't have chosen the path I did, I wouldn't have learned as much about life, perhaps wouldn't have learned as much about myself and about my spirituality. And it seems to me that that's an awful lot of what your memoir is about, too, that the choice you made actually took you on a path that allowed you to learn a lot more about God and about your relationship with God than if you'd chosen the other path that would have been more of a straight line to God by being a Jesuit priest.
Well, I would say that, you know, in my own experience, yes, it's the case that, you know, if I have a path to heaven, it's through my wife and my children, absolutely, and for sure. And I was certainly called to that. You know, on the other hand, marriage and child rearing has its own kind of challenges and its own kinds of difficulties. But celibacy does too. If me and I were running things in the Catholic Church, I would say that celibate priesthood and, you know, married priesthood, you know, that there could be room for both. I believe very much that there could be room for both. I don't completely agree. You know, everyone has their own kind of experience. But I something that Reverend Tomino said just a little while ago is very important to me, that you know, just because she hasn't experienced the life of celibacy doesn't mean she can't speak to it or comment on it. You know, that it's very much about empathy, not only to be a good preacher or a priest or a leader of people, but to be, you know, for me, to be a good writer. You know, I don't have to have been murdered to write a good story about murder. And therefore, you know, your imagination and your capacity for empathy is hugely, hugely important. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't judge celibate priests. You know, I do regret that. I regret that there were some channels in Catholicism that made me feel as if a celibate priesthood is a higher calling or is the highest calling. That hurt because I couldn't measure up. I couldn't live that way. However, the best celibate priests did not talk that way to me, and they did not feel that, they did not make me feel that way, and they still don't. So I still have a great deal of respect for celibacy. But yes, for me, you know, if you want to read a story about a guy who couldn't handle the celibacy stuff and absolutely needed women in his life, and, you know, the path of being a father and of being a husband was the way to go, with a lot of brokenness and yelling at God along the way, then please read The Path, my new memoir, because that's what you'll find in there.
Again, the book is called The Dark Path, and the author is David Schickler, who's also a screenwriter and a novelist. David, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you. It's been wonderful, and thank you to Mark and Danielle and to all of your listeners. It's a wonderful thing to be part of your show. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mark LaValle, before I let you go, we just have a few minutes here left. One thing I wanted to put to you is these comments that we've made reference to, but we haven't really dug into, that the Pope recently made, is as he talks about potentially the Catholic Church making too much of homosexuality and abortion and contraception. Do you think that this idea of celibacy in the priesthood, ordained men only, that these are things that may be raised maybe by this Pope or sometime soon in the history of the Church?
Well, there's been recent statements by the current Secretary of State in the Vatican that what we call it is mandatory celibacy for ordained priesthood, is something that could be on the table, so to speak, for conversation about possible changes or looking at it in different ways. The standard line of the Catholic Church would always be that mandatory celibacy for priests is not a solemn doctrine. It's not dogma. It's more of a discipline. And it has a very, very long history. And there's very, very good theological reasons and even some practical ones for priestly celibacy, but it's not ultimately a necessity of Catholic faith. So, I mean, that's one of the things that could possibly change. Tradition is always an evolving or developing system of practices and understandings. So it's not, you know, it's not absolutely necessary. The Orthodox Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, have married priests, but bishops have to be celibate. So most of the bishops in the Orthodox Church generally come from monasteries. I think that religious orders would probably remain celibate because most of them live in community, and also because celibacy tends to be more of a mark of monastic life than for diocesan priesthood, so to speak. And there's, you know, there's Episcopalian priests who've married and then became Catholic and wanted to still remain priests. And there's been more allowance for that. Catholic Church recently.
It seems as though there's perhaps more movement to come. Dr. Mark LaValle is assistant professor of practical theology at Barry University. He joined us by phone today. Mark, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Great. Glad to be here.
And thank you to our friend, Reverend Danielle Tomenio, who joined us and helped us to lead this conversation today. Always good to see you, Danielle. Thank you so much for being here.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives with Betsy Kaplan and help from Heather Brandon. The senior producer of our show is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.